we unleash something powerful. We call her the Ghost. She could destroy the world.
I'd love to help you. I'm under house arrest.
We'll have you home by lunch.
I'm gonna come with you guys.
Awesome.
Great job back there.
Thanks.
Are you gonna say the same thing to me?
Good job.
Thank you.
Hiya, champ. How was school today?
Ha 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 ha. So cranky.
You know, I'm an Avenger now.
Yeah, so you've mentioned.
No, I know that. I just want to make sure that these guys do.
We unleashed something powerful. We have to stop her.
If you want to do something right, you make a list. One, we have to team up. Two, we're gonna have to fight Ghost. Three, we're gonna track down Ghost. That seems like it should be part of two. 2A. Oh, also, we have to save the world. That's major. We can't forget that.
The only chance we've got is together.
There is another person I can think of. What's up?
Maybe I'm doing it wrong. What's up? What's
up? You have no idea what I'm capable of.
She just wanted to give me a hug. Wish me luck.
Really?
Yeah.
Watch this.
Sorry, I'm messing around.
Wish I had a suit. Even with like minimal powers. Or maybe even just a suit with no powers.
No.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Matinee Conversations. I am Tyler Shorter of Matinee Myths, and I'm here with Jameson Smallwood of Culture and Conversations. How's it going, Jameson?
Hey, buddy. What's going on, man? I'm doing good.
All right, and today we are discussing Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Or as I like to say, the Wasps.
The Wasps. What did you think of it, man, right off the bat, before we get into the spoiler section of it?
I think we'll save our grades for a little bit later. Maybe kind of give people a chance to kind of get into the podcast a little bit before we give it a grade. But overall, I was very happy with it. Definitely a much better offering than Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom was.
And of course, watching paint dry would be a much better offering than Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom.
We're still taking shots at that movie, people.
Such an easy target.
It was, yeah. It's such an easy target. That's low. Any insult there is low-hanging fruit.
I mean, we can make fun of it. It still made over $2 billion, so.
Yeah, they're laughing at us all the way to the bank. So.
That's right.
But, no, man, I really enjoyed Ant-Man and the Wasp. Or Ant-Man 2, as people probably thinking of it. Mm-hmm. One of the things I liked about the movie is that it's a very self-contained storyline. So even though Ant-Man is definitely a part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and you saw that with his cameo in, you know, Civil War,
yeah.
You know, and you saw that clearly. But they do a good job in his series and in his story of keeping him from being sort of full-blown in their world. You know, in terms of the story, there's not like pieces of the Marvel Cinematic Universe that have to unfold in order for you to get Ant-Man's story. So I like that part of it. And, you know, this is my take on this too, Tyler, just kind of throw this back at you. One of the things with Marvel movies that I've kind of been critical of is that the second movie of the franchise for a particular character, it always feels a little bit like a throwaway movie. So going all the way back to Iron Man.
Yeah, Iron Man 2, definitely yeah. Forgettable.
Yeah, Iron Man 2. I felt the same way about Thor, you know, or Dark World. And and I felt the same way also about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. I thought that one felt a little throwaway-ish as well. So, you know, for them to come back and give you like such a solid movie for Ant-Man that actually continue Ant-Man's story. And I think that's why it I think that's why it felt good that it didn't really tie. It doesn't really tie us too hard into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, even though it clearly is a part of it. Because I think that's why those other movies felt like a throwaway movie, is that they didn't advance the Marvel Cinematic Universe that much when they came out with their sequels.
Right. And there definitely was a trend there that I didn't notice, but you definitely shined a light on that. Yeah, definitely the follow-up, at least of the solo movies of those stories, have been pretty weak consistently. And yeah, this definitely broke the trend, because I agree, it was a very good standalone movie. And like you said, it didn't really affect the overall Marvel universe.
Yeah, I think that is what probably gives it some major points in my book. Also, too, I got to be honest, you know, I feel like Ant-Man is kind of the bonus material for the Marvel Cinematic Universe, almost even more so than the Guardians of the Galaxy was. Because with the Guardians of the Galaxy, it really expanded your perspective on the universe, mm-hmm. because it took you into outer space and into different parts of the galaxy and introduced all these aliens and characters. But with Ant-Man, it doesn't really feel like it's properly rooted in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So it kind of feels like bonus material, and it's really good bonus material. It's to me, it's some of the better storytelling movie-wise in the Marvel offering of movies.
Yeah, I agree. And being a fan of the actual comics, in the actual comic books, especially in the Ultimate series, they follow more closely the story of Hank Pym, which is Michael Douglas in this movie.
Okay.
And it kind of goes with, you know, the modern heroes like Tony Stark and all them. And he was a very interesting character in the comics. And I mean, he struggled with alcohol abuse, and he actually got physical with his wife, which was the Wasp at that point.
Okay.
And he seemed to always have a chip on his shoulder, and there were great interactions, since he's a great mind. And there was always these great interactions with Tony Stark and Reed Richards. And Pym was always like, it's my way or the highway, and always butting heads. And there was a mm-hmm. good dynamic there. But I don't really need that in the cinematic universe, since we already know Tony Stark kind of butts heads with everybody. and it's glorious.
Yes. But I think – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, I think, you know, we may want to – I think this is where we may want to insert our spoiler alert right here, because there's something that happened in the movie that I think kind of hints at his character, Hank Prim's character, being difficult to get along with, and it showed up in this movie in a big way.
All right, let's go ahead and hit him with the spoiler alert. Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert!
Spoiler alerts. Spoiler alert. There we go. All right. So we're, so in the movie, you kind of get a more of a vision of who Hank has been in his past life. And one of the characters who was played by Lawrence Fishburne, mm-hmm. The character's name is Bill Foster.
I was calling him Morpheus this whole time.
This is how we get the hate mail, Tyler. Start mixing the movie franchises.
I'm sorry. Once he played Morpheus, he's always going to be Morpheus to me.
He's always like Morpheus.
His previous role, Boys in the Hood and all that, just thrown out the window. He's Morpheus.
He's Morpheus. He's retroactively known as Morpheus. He's not Furious Styles. No, he's Morpheus.
That's right.
Morpheus playing Furious Styles. But yeah, he, you know, this guy, this other scientist, or the one of the antagonists in the movie, his name is Bill Foster, who's played by Lawrence Fishburne. And apparently Bill and Hank have this past where they've butted heads in the past. And Hank, you know, he goes on to become more successful and have a little bit more longevity in the particular work he was doing with, you know, shrinking atoms and protons and all that stuff down. But he alienated Bill Foster, which proves to be, you know, one of the pivotal pieces of the plot going forward in Ant-Man 2.
Right. Now, from everything I know about Hank Pym, that's pretty nail on the head right there. He doesn't play well with others.
Yeah.
He's very individualist. He in the comic book series, he wanted to just, you know, he wanted to break free from everyone. Once he figured out how he can make himself large, he's like, well, I can handle everything myself. I don't need anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Even his life partner, the Wasp. It's like, yeah, I can handle everything now. So he was very difficult in the comics. And yeah, I consider Michael Douglas can play that role very well. And I don't know if you've heard, there's talks about being a prequel, or at least him appearing as a very much younger Hank Pym.
Oh.
And since Captain Marvel is going to be played in the past, the upcoming Captain Marvel, maybe he'll make an appearance then?
So they are going to bring us Captain Marvel before the current timeline where Thanos has killed everybody.
This is before any event of Iron Man or the Avengers or anything. It's way before everything.
Oh, wow.
Years ago.
Wow.
I know this because I stalk Sam Jackson, as you all know. And I just read a news right before recording that they are de-aging him for the Captain Marvel. No eye patch. And he has hair.
So
yeah, it's definitely taken place in the past, maybe 80s, maybe 90s.
I don't know how I feel about that, because I'm thirsty for more information about life post Thanos.
Well, so they have to introduce Captain Marvel, and they can't introduce Captain Marvel in Avengers or the next Avengers without having some sort of backstory.
I got you. Because the timeline doesn't work for a good intro story.
Right. And and plus there's no Sam Jackson in the newest story. And they got all my letters.
Yeah. Cool.
But yes.
So that makes sense then about Hank Pym's character, where he's difficult and he alienates people and the people he's worked with in the past. And, you know, so that kind of helps set the story. So I guess to kind of bring them into the world, our listeners into the world a little bit, you know, you basically pick up after the story picks up after the events of Civil War for Ant-Man, who's, mm-hmm, who's Scott Lang. That's his alter ego.
Right.
And, you know, so Scott.
But before Thanos.
Exactly. But before Thanos.
Yes.
Which is something that you won't know watching the movie, but it makes sense after you kind of see how calm things actually are. Yeah. So for a while, I kind of thought that maybe this was life post Thanos, but you know, which is what made that cut scene in the first cut scene really, really painful again. Because you basically get Thanos, you know, Thanos's wrath unfold in that cutscene.
Mm. You're talking about the one where they're in the van?
Yeah. And he's going in to harvest quantum healing particles. And then all of a sudden there's radio silence. And the only thing you see is people being vaporized by Thanos. And the people Hank, his wife, and Hope Van Dyne, you know, you see her get vaporized too into dust.
And he's stuck in the quantum realm.
Yeah, he's stuck in limbo.
Now, my biggest bone that I have to pick on that is, why wasn't he fighting alongside the Avengers?
This is true. So now that this kind of makes, I think this is my theory, and I'll see how you feel about it. I think the reason why was, one, there was the house arrest thing going on, where post-Civil War, he got locked up and we see him in prison, but basically he has to plea bargain his way out of it to get back to his regular life. So he's on house arrest. And then secondly, on top of that, you see that Hank and his daughter Hope are consumed with the work of trying to basically build this teleport device that allows them to enter the quantum realm to go find Hank's wife and to bring her back.
So, no, I agree with the the events in the movie, but I'm talking in the post-credit scene. Like, he's in the van in the Quantum Realm, mm-hmm. while everyone else is assumingly fighting Thanos.
I think it's just, you know, now that may be a weak point of the plot, so I don't want to give it too much support, but I think what's going on there is that all of that stuff was happening around the same time. Like I said, while they were trying to, you know, get back Janet Van Dyne from the Quantum Realm. And on top of that too, you know, they were just busy with their own mess, even though they do seem to be totally oblivious to the fact that Thanos has appeared and is trying to take over the world and, you know, and get the stones,
they're,
you know,
pretty bad superheroes if they don't see a spaceship in New York, that space donut that they had there.
Yeah. Yeah. So is that where they're located? Are they in New York, or are they in like San Francisco?
Well, I believe in the van scene, they were over in New York.
Okay. Or at least,
I'm not 100% sure, but I mean, at least they can watch the news.
Yeah. No doubt. You would think there would be some information that they would have been privy to see that all that stuff was going on.
And you don't think they would have been called in to? I mean, he fought alongside the superhero, so you think the superhero would be like, hey, we could probably use this guy. You know, it was kind of an all-hands-on-deck situation.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. You would have thought they would have responded a little bit better there as well, you know.
So. I understand. They're probably going to utilize him in the next installment of the Thanos saga. So
according to Wikipedia, as we go really deep for our listeners on Madden Conversations, apparently the movie was filmed in Pinewood Atlanta Studios, which is in Fayette County, Georgia. That's outside of Atlanta for those people who care, as well as Metro Atlanta, which is a little bit more of the surrounding area closer to Atlanta. And then San Francisco, they mentioned San Francisco as a location, as well as Savannah, Georgia, and Hawaii. But in terms of the setting, I don't see anything in the article that kind of gives us a primer on where they actually were at. So, mm-hmm. But even to your point, regardless of where they were at, I agree. They should have been aware of what was happening in the world with the events of this big, huge battle going on in Wakanda, as mm-hmm. well as Thanos appearing, you know, they should have been aware of it.
I mean, it was a world altering event. Well, it was a universe altering event.
Yeah.
You got people coming from wherever they were floating around, where Thor was ever floating around, and then getting the hammer or the Stormbreaker. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if he can come from there, I'm sure Scott can make the trek across country.
Yeah.
Across planet.
He can get there and help out. So, So let me ask you this question too, man. So that's a fairly valid criticism. I can rock with that. How did you feel about the villain who was in the movie Ghost? How did you feel about her?
I really enjoyed the layers of her character. I don't claim to be a massive comic book nerd. Okay. I mean, I'm more of a DC guy anyway, sure. So I never even heard of her. Now, it's true, she did look like a video game Destiny character. But her story is, you know, I can tell, like, all right, she's falling apart. You can tell that right off the bat. She has this power that's obviously causing her pain, and she wants to remove that.
That's true.
And you know, if you poke a bear that's in pain, they're going to fight back no matter where they're at, you know?
Yeah. And she's already suffered a lot of loss in her life because, you know, she got those powers or those – or that disability, depending on how you look at it, which apparently by the end of the movie, you see that's a disability more so than powers. She got that by losing her parents in this crazy physics experiment where she got bombarded with quantum, mm-hmm. you know, dimensional energy. And it just gave her these great layers to your point that, you know, she then gets adopted by S.H.I.E.L.D., who lies to her to promise, oh, we're going to heal you, when all they want to do is weaponize her and use her in the war for, you know, use her as a weapon in their particular war against different nations and countries to, you know, for different purposes. And finally, she gets to the point where her life's at risk because her condition is deteriorating. So that gives her the motivation to try to steal the equipment and the laboratory that keeps shrinking down, which I thought that was a pretty cool thing to be fighting over, this miniaturized laboratory that could, that they could control and change the scale of. You know, she goes and looks for it and hunts down Hank and his daughter, Hope. And that's what kind of sets the conflict into motion, is that she's trying to get this equipment that she thinks is going to save her from being torn apart by her, her, you know, shifting in and out of phase, quantumly speaking.
Yeah, I really enjoyed her character, and you know, it's a mission, I guess you could say, that you can get behind. You're like, I can feel for this, you know, we'll call her a villain.
Yeah.
Even though she's probably reacting the same way any of us would have reacted in the situation.
No, I totally agree with that. That's a great point. You know, one of the things about the movie too, you realize there's not really a villain. The closest thing to a villain, a true villain, probably was the crime boss guy.
Yeah, who was I didn't know what he actually was. You know, it's just some sort of a southern guy, and he likes to wear white and had a Cadillac.
That's it. And he had apparently had a restaurant that had poor health.
Yeah.
You know,
I just call him Boss Hog. 2018.
Yeah. I'm actually looking for his name, and I don't see it listed among the credits, which is kind of weird, but you know, it was cool. I mean, he was a fairly interesting character. Not terribly developed and deep, but he just was nice to throw in the mix as a third person trying to get this technology in this laboratory, you know, at all costs. So I thought it was nice to kind of throw him in the mix. Might have been an unnecessary piece to the puzzle of the plot, but you know, once again, in fairness to, you know, how we kind of look at movies, at least how I look at them, he didn't detract from the movie. So he actually added value there. So may not have been a lot of value, but he didn't hurt the movie storyline with his quest for the equipment either.
Yeah, I kind of liked him. He was purely motivated by money.
Yeah.
And you know, it was very, very easy to understand his prime directive, and yeah, I enjoyed his inclusion in that movie as well.
Yeah, I see his name now. His name is Sonny Birch. That's the character's.
I was listening to it, I thought they said senator at the beginning, and I'm like, this guy is way, way too shady to be a senator. And then I was like, wait a minute, Trump's president. maybe he is senator.
Shots fired. Yeah, he was definitely trying to grab them in the he was trying to definitely grab their parts, to put it that way.
Yeah.
But
I liked him, and I would agree he was probably the main antagonist of the film. Mm-hmm. I believe Ghost's character I would call her a misguided ally.
Okay. I like that. You know, and it made a lot of sense, because when for him to be in there as a black market tech dealer, because when the events of the first movie unfolded plus Civil War, you basically have Hank unable to show his face in public and order the parts that he needs to build the equipment that he's trying to construct, because he's a fugitive, you know, from justice. Mm-hmm. The Sokovia Accords that, you know, Scott Lang, Ant-Man, violated by basically fighting against Iron Man and being on Team Cap, right, in Civil War, it indicted Hank, which, you know, sent Hank into hiding, and him and his daughter having to be on the run and deal with this shady guy, Sonny Burst, to get these parts that they need. So, yeah. So we're fairly deep into the podcast now, Tyler. I guess now would be a good time to reveal our scores as we begin to hit the home stretch. What did you give it in terms of your rating system? How'd you rate it?
Well, I'll go ahead and let you give your score first, because I'm going to explain why I scored it mine right after. It would kind of tie into the whole issue.
I got you. So I was really high on this movie. I came out of there when I saw it, you know, and I said, okay, I'm somewhere between 85 and 90 you know, thinking through it and listening, you know, to some of your feedback, I think I'm settling in on a score of 88. You know, I feel like that's a pretty good score for it. Not quite an A, but it's a high B. It was a really strong movie. You know, I think I could even be, you know, yeah, I'm gonna hang around an 88. You know, I think that I was a little bit of a victim of the moment. You know, when I saw them the people vaporized by Thanos in the credit scene. But I felt like that was smart because it took me right back to the emotional gut punch that you get left with in Infinity Wars, which I thought that was genius. I'm like, okay, they're not gonna give you any hope.
Pouring salt into the wounds.
Exactly. And I thought that was beautifully done. Matter of fact, now that I say that out loud, I'm giving it a 90 because of that. They can get those 2 points, man, to get to a 90. Because I thought that gut punch in the end was beautiful. It just hit me right in the chest again. I felt the exact same way I felt when I saw the end of Infinity War. So
I'll go ahead and reveal my score. It was a bit lower than yours. I'm going to give it an 83.
Oh, you come down a little bit since just a
tad. I went down to 80, but then the post credits, I gave it a point each for each benefit of that. Okay, so I'm settling at 83, and I'll tell you why. Okay, I love the comedy in the movie. Paul Rudd's a comedic actor. He's a great comedic actor. I still feel this is a problem I had with the original Ant-Man. I don't think he's a leading man. He's a great character actor. And a little too much Paul Rudd for me. I know I knew it coming in, but I really enjoy him in an ensemble.
Oh, okay.
And I love the interactions between him and his daughter and I don't know the character's name, but Michael Peña.
Louise.
Yeah, those were great. It just got a little too thick. It's like too much of a good thing.
Well, I think what happened there to support what you're saying is that Louise did a great job in the first Ant-Man. I think he was the breakout star in terms of the franchise with his role as his role played by Michael Peña. So when you come into this movie, they want to give us more Louise because, you know, he's a little bit bigger star now too because of that movie. And I felt like Scott's character or Scott Lang or Paul Rudd's character got diminished a little bit more and that they sort of had to work in other pieces of the story to kind of flesh out or other characters who are part of the story to kind of flesh out the plot some. So I see what you're saying with that. Continue. Well, let me let you finish your thoughts, man.
Yeah. I'll say that I really enjoyed their interactions. It was a little rough when he started interacting with Hank Pym and his daughter. I was like, he's still making these jokes like he's around his best friend and his daughter. So, you know, it just felt a little too goofy for me in some moments.
Okay.
Just brief moments. And that's not the issue that I really have with the movie.
Okay.
The issue that I had, which is also with the original Ant-Man, and I was going to cover it in a Matinee Myth Science Edition, but I'll go ahead and address it here so I don't have to do it.
Uh-oh.
And I have no problem with suspending belief, but if you guys put in the movie how something works and you explain how it works, and then you just toggle that switch on and off like it doesn't matter, That's when it kind of bugs me.
Okay.
So we're explained in the original film about how the Ant-Man suit works. And he explains that he doesn't take away any of the particles. He just changes the space between.
I remember that. Yeah, he takes the molecular space out between the particles to condense it down.
Now, when Scott first puts on the suit, is displayed. Let's just say Paul Rudd weighs 170, 180. Mm-hmm. He puts on the suit, shrinks down, he's still going to weigh 170 or 180. And in the original movie, he puts the suit on, shrinks down, he's in the bathroom. that 180 pounds hits on one bathroom tile and then it kind of shatters it.
I remember that. Yeah.
That would have been, fairly accurate. Excuse me. And that's how 180 pounds would work when it's on a pinpoint. So throughout the rest of the movie of the original, that was just thrown out unless it was convenient
for the story. Yeah.
Right. And it's still the case in this one. The biggest bone I had in the first one was Hank Pym was walking around with a tank in his pocket as a keychain, if you remember.
I remember that, yeah.
And the tank weighs about 150 tons. And he's carrying it around in his pocket. It's still going to weigh it. It's just more dense at this point.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, that's some strong pockets.
And he does that. He also, I'm sorry.
Stop. I'm talking over you. Go ahead. I was going to dive into the problems with this movie, but go ahead.
Well, I was just going to throw you an alley oop there. What about how'd you feel about his carrying case full of cars that he was walking around with?
Yes. Yeah, I was going to dive into that, but also the building you thought was so cool. He's walking around with a skyscraper. He's carrying around a skyscraper on those little roller wheels that you have on your luggage.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have she would shoot stuff to make it bigger, like in the chase scene where he throws the Pez dispenser out, makes it gigantic, crashes into a car, mayhem.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the problem with that, when you expand it, it's still going to have the same mass as the Pez dispenser that fits in your hand. Exactly. It's going to bounce off of it like a beach ball,
just like a Pez dispenser would.
Yeah, exactly. And being that they could just fluctuate and be fluid with it, the whole concept of mass versus size and density, just when it's convenient for them, that was an issue for me.
No, that's inconsistency. That's I would call that a continuity problem.
Right. And then, like you said, the whole carrying around a whole fleet of cars.
Because that's what's supposed to make Ant-Man get super, if you will, is that to your point, he's a 180-pound man, but he's the size of your thumb. So he's got this heavy density, and that's what gives him the same strength, this crazy proportion, disproportionate strength to his size. So here he is the size of your thumb, and he's still hitting you with the force of,
And it's all focused on that one point.
Yeah.
Where, a punch from Ant-Man would be like a bullet going through you.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't be able to ride an ant because he's still weighing 180 pounds.
there it is. The inconvenience.
Another issue, when he gets giant sized, he's still 180 pounds. He's probably going to, if it went by the way it was explained, he's probably going to be semi-translucent at this point because his atoms are so stretched apart, and he's still going to have the strength of a 180-pound man.
That's
he's
true.
He's not going to be able to pick up a guy with his little finger. He's not going to be able to stop a ship.
No, that's true. There are definitely some continuity problems there, and he wouldn't have sunk into the bay either when he fell into the water. He would have really floated because he would have been 180 pounds spread over such a large surface area.
Yeah,
he wouldn't have sunken. He wouldn't have been sunken. He would have floated. So, I'll throw one out there while we're talking about the science a little bit. There was a scene where Hank was descending into the quantum realm,
mm-hmm.
and there were these basically. I mean, he was subatomic at that point, and there were these little creatures floating around. And because he was talking about, you never told me that the quantum realm was so beautiful, and there was these creatures floating around. And first off, those creatures are made up of, would have had cells, and those cells would have, not been that small in order to be able to organize themselves into an organism. So the organism basically was in the scale, whatever that organism was that he saw in the quantum realm. I remember seeing something about that on the internet years ago, that actual creature that they put into that quantum realm. Yeah. But basically it's not the scale. And that was my problem with the science there.
I give him a pass on that. And I can't remember the name of the creature as well. I know that they're very durable, and I don't think Pym was in the quantum realm at that point. He was still shrinking. So that's why I gave him a pass on that.
Oh.
Because, you know, he got so small that the creatures couldn't find him anymore.
And, well, that's true.
Yeah. But those creatures, man, I really wish I knew the name of them. Those things are about the only organisms that we know of that can survive in outer space for extended periods. Radiation, vacuum, everything. They're super durable.
Yeah, I'm just looking at
Tardigrade.
What is it?
Tardigrade.
Tardigrade. Yeah, Tardigrade. Yeah, man. That's it. That's a Tardigrade. Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the Tardigrade.
Also called water bears.
Yeah, man, that was a good. I don't know how you pulled that one up, man. That was good.
I actually remembered the name, and I was trying to spell it, but I spelled it wrong, but I still found it.
But even those, I mean, according to Wikipedia, which is the authority on all things, basically the adult size of those things is like 1.2 micrometers, not micrometers, but millimeters. So still not atomic or anywhere close to subatomic, but. You know, I get it. They just threw them in. And I think there's some hints there, according to one of the spoilers I read just now, looking for that animal, is that I think there's a hint that just as Guardians of the Galaxy expanded outward our notion of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Ant-Man's story is to expand the Marvel Universe inward into this quantum, you know, microverse, if you will. And I think that's part of why they've put those creatures there, is to kind of help put those things, to kind of put our minds into the frame that the universe is much bigger than what we think it is. Mm-hmm. You know, there's even mention in that article about there being possible civilizations at the quantum level, you know, formed by organisms or whatever. And that might be what Ant-Man is going to be exploring while he's waiting to return back to the world in chaos right now because of Thanos.
Now, my big issue with Ant-Man is he's probably one of the most powerful superheroes in the Marvel Universe when you think about it. I have a plan using him to defeat Thanos.
Mm-hmm.
You shrink him down.
Okay.
Get somebody to bring him to Thanos. He gets to the gauntlet. He shrinks the gauntlet. Now Thanos can't wear it anymore.
And that's the end of the story there, man.
That would be just too easy.
I was thinking about something more like him just getting micro, then, you know, popping out one of the stones and putting that to the end, you know. But yeah, I can go with anything with that. And maybe that's why they kept him away from, you know, the battle, because mm-hmm. I think he is one of those sledgehammers that if you're just logical enough about it, you can see him being used to defeat Thanos fairly quickly.
Yeah, especially when you're so loose with his actual power set and give him super strength when he's gigantic. That's a slam dunk.
Wow. Yeah, I think you're dead on there. So yeah, so would you recommend people go see Ant-Man 2, a.k.a. Ant-Man and the Wasp?
Most definitely. It was a very enjoyable movie. And, yeah, I would watch it again if somebody wanted to go see it with me, you know. What about you?
Yeah, I would definitely recommend going to see it. And one thing I will tell you to do as my recommendation, go see it in 3D. I would have seen it in 3D, but my particular theater only had an 11:30 a.m. showing of the movie in 3D, But it's clearly, when you look at the 2D movie, it's clear that they have some great 3D effects going on, especially with Ghost and how she's phasing in and out. You know, Ant-Man shrinking, because I saw Ant-Man 1 in 3D and it was amazing. So I would say, I would suggest you go see Ant-Man 2 in 3D if you can stomach 3D movies. I think it'd be money well spent.
Yeah, if I get back there, I'm definitely going to check it out in 3D if I get the opportunity.
Yeah, I think that would be the – I think that's what I would tell – that's my recommendation to the listeners as well, man. Go see it in 3D. Because some movies you go see in 3D, you can tell that they just kind of sprinkled on some 3D-isms. Mm-hmm. But this movie clearly was shot with 3D in mind. You know, you got all these great effects. It's Portal and the Into the Quantum Realm.
Traveling through you know, the different sizes. I could definitely see that being portrayed quite well in 3D format.
Yeah, and I would love to see what the Quantum Realm looks like in 3D as well. You know, just out all those colors and
the moving parts.
Yeah, yeah, yes. Yeah. I bet that was awesome. You know, even that scene where he is kind of like, "Oh, you didn't tell me how beautiful the Quantum Realm was," where they were looking at the tardigrades. You know, I bet that whole scene there was amazing too in 3D.
So. Yeah, no doubt.
So cool. But yeah, man.
I definitely recommend it, and maybe I'll come up there and we'll watch it in 3D.
Oh, man, that sounds like a plan, man. Sounds like a plan. So, you know, Culture and Conversations listeners, Madden and Myths listeners, we're going to shout out our podcasts, our respective podcasts. And I don't know if we've picked the next movie that we're going to want to watch. But, yeah, we got something. We'll pick something and we'll put it out and let you guys know about it. So, yeah. So Tyler, what's your podcast, man?
Madden and Myths, maddenandmyths.podbean.com. I don't always sound this raspy, but... It's been a rough day. It's the end of my day right now. Yeah, you can always check me out on Facebook or Twitter at Matinee Myths. Email is matineemythspodcast@gmail.com. And I would like to go ahead and announce the next little bonus show that I plan on doing is with my wife, and it's called Netflix No Chill.
Oh, nice.
We're going to doing the same thing just with Netflix movies, or maybe just not Netflix exclusive movies, but movies that we find on Netflix that may be forgotten or just little hidden gems.
So how are you guys going to do other streaming services as well?
Nah, just Netflix. That's all we got.
Oh man. Here I am shooting a hole in your podcast model already, but Netflix works because everybody has Netflix. I think that's most ubiquitous.
We almost watch Netflix exclusively, so
cool.
It works. You know, we're just going to be talking about it, and you guys can listen in.
Well, I support that because I always need somebody to help me navigate Netflix. You know, I try to use my Facebook timeline for it, and I got to be honest. You know, with the exception of a few very sensible people like yourself, when it comes to movies, you know, either things suck or things are great. And most of the time, what I find is I think there's some kind of psychology at work. If people spend money to go see the movie, they say that it was good. Mm-hmm. So like, it doesn't matter what movie it is. It doesn't matter how it ends. Like, I got people raving about Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom on my timeline. And
I'm really defriend them.
I was just about to say that I'm really thinking about defriending them because I'm like, you're just not a trustworthy source of movie critiques. So repeat that again, man, just so people make sure they get it. You said Netflix, No Chill.
Netflix, No Chill. You're going to be able to, if you subscribe to Matinee Myths on any podcatcher you have, it's going to be probably next Saturday will be the first episode.
Sweet. Well, that gives us something to look forward to. You know, I'm subscribed to Matinee Myths, so I'll definitely listen to it when it comes out. And my podcast is Culture and Conversations. That's cultureandconversations.com, where you can find all the episodes. You can find a link to subscribe to the podcast with your favorite podcast catcher and or application. Also, I'm in iTunes, just like Tyler. We're both in iTunes.
Spotify. We're both in Spotify now, too.
So, yeah, we're both in Spotify now. We're also on the Google Play platform. So,
and that new Google Podcasts.
Yeah, cool, man.
Use that one.
Sweet. And then, you know, Stitcher as well. So you can find us on in Stitcher and a couple other little directories that, you know, just basically consume and redistribute podcasts. So you can email me, cultureandconversations@gmail.com. And if you want to play around and hang out with me on my Facebook page for the podcast, that's Culture and Conversations. on Facebook, and also Culture and Conversations on Instagram. And, you know, the Facebook page is sort of extra content on top of what you're getting from the podcast. So I go live and I talk about stuff that's happening with the podcast. I talk about things that you may have heard on the podcast, kind of like behind the scenes, where I explain certain things and talk about maybe what a poem or something means that I wrote on a podcast.
And I jump on there and harass them from time to time.
Yeah, it's cool. It's like we're friends, but yeah. Not really. But then we are. And people don't know that we really like each other, even though sometimes we say mean things to each other on Facebook.
We say mean things, but with love.
With feeling and love. So, but yeah, that's the particulars of the show. You guys are great. Thank you guys for listening to Matinee Conversations and, you know, obviously encouraging us to take our friendship and put it in audio format. So I enjoy doing these episodes and I make time for it. And yeah, I hope you guys enjoy this episode.
Yeah. And I love you all.
Thank you for being part of the conversation.
There you go.
Sweet. Yeah, I think that was a good episode, man. I'm so glad you brought up the science piece. I didn't know if you were going to touch on that, but you nailed it, man. Like I think that was the part where it got kind of crazy after a while, because it kind of felt like they had painted themselves a bit into the corner when they explained, mm-hmm. Ant-Man in the first movie. I would have just been cool with some fake science where it's just like, oh well, you know, we've got this scientific device that can enlarge you and shrink you, and then leave it at that. And then they could have done whatever all the stuff that they were doing, you know.
Well, I mean, honestly, enlarging and shrinking is an awesome power by itself.
Yeah.
And you essentially give him super strength when he's in giant mode, and still proportional strength when he's smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's still... it's an awesome power to have, and it could definitely be utilized.
Yeah, I agree. It has a place in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.